market rate, £3,000 a day. Were you signing Lionel Messi? This is First Minister's Questions. Just once, it would be nice to get a First Minister's answer.
For Douglas Ross to stand there and talk about losing grip of a party when he's been leader, the Conservatives have had the longest attempted coup in Scottish political history.
The Steenie, a politics podcast from The Scotsman.
Hello and welcome to The Steamy, The Scotsman's politics podcast. I'm Alistair Grant, The Scotsman's political editor, and it is recess. The Scottish Parliament is on a two-week Easter break. I'm actually sitting in an empty Scottish Parliament at the moment just to try and get the internet signal to do this podcast. But that does not mean that politics has ground to a halt. On the contrary, an almighty political row has broken out after the hugely controversial Hate Crime Act came into force on April 1st. I'll be joined by David Ball, The Scotsman's deputy political editor, to talk about how that row developed over the last few days. Later on in the podcast, I'll chat to Catherine Hay, The Scotsman's rural affairs correspondent, about the epic six-month walk she is currently embarking on around Scotland, during which she'll be reporting from every corner of the country. It's an incredibly cool project that, to me at least, harks back to the golden ages of journalism, and I can't wait to find out more from her about how it's going so far. But first, hate crime. And a row that has now gone global with interventions from high-profile figures such as J.K. Rowling. Just to remind people, the Hate Crime Act, which was passed in 2021, but only came into force at the start of this month, consolidates existing hate crime law, but crucially creates a new offence of stirring up hatred against protected characteristics, including age, sexual orientation, and transgender identity. A stirring up offence on the basis of race has been on the statute book in Scotland since 1986, but the new legislation has sparked real concerns about a potential chilling of freedom of expression. We understand police have already received thousands of complaints under the new act, although the force has not officially confirmed that. And there have long been concerns about how the new law will be implemented. David, this law came into force on Monday, and it's fair to say it's been a bit of a nightmare for the Scottish Government ever since. What happened this week?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a mess. It launched on Monday, as we know, 3 years after the legislation was passed. J.K. Rowling, who has been quite a big critic of the legislation in the run-up to it, put out a series of tweets basically goading Police Scotland to arrest me, is what she asked them to do, by sort of misgendering people and saying that she was probably going to get arrested and it was a sort of a threat to freedom of speech. There's just been quite a big row about it. Like you said, the police have been sort of swamped with thousands of complaints, people reporting people for apparent hate crime. Even the minister responsible, Siobhan Brown, someone as sort of a fake complaint in her name was passed to police, and she was surprised to find the police sort of ringing her up and asking her about her complaint. So J.K. Rowling sort of started it going, but the police kind of said it wasn't a criminal offence. It was just to be, it just didn't meet the criminal threshold, basically. But from there, we've just seen a lot of people getting excited about what makes a hate crime, what doesn't, and a lot of inconsistencies from Police Scotland's sort of handling of it.
Yeah, so as you say, J.K. Rowling, a kind of long-term critic of the Scottish Government on its kind of gender reform policy, for example, going back to when that was going through Parliament, long-term kind of outspoken on the kind of wider trans debate. And as you say, she had that Twitter thread that she posted in which she essentially kind of listed as various kind of transgender women, some of them, you know, violent criminals, a couple of them trans activists. And at the end of it, she effectively said, you know, they're men, essentially. And she had that kind of long tweet at the end of the thread in which she effectively said, you know, if the police believe that I've committed an offence, I think she said she's out of the country at the moment, but, you know, if the police believe, like you say, she had a hashtag saying arrest me. I mean, it was very, it made the issue explode into the headlines, I think, in a way across the UK that, you know, this has been a kind of ongoing debate in Scotland, but it really took it global. I mean, we've kind of seen this reported around the world now. There's been a lot of, I mean, I can just see my own tweets getting retweeted by people in America, for example. So it's just been a kind of extraordinary row over the past couple of days. And the other thing about J.K. Rowling's tweet is that the police have now said that they will not be recorded as a non-crime hate incident. And just to explain, in case any listeners don't know, according to Police Scotland's own guidance, non-crime hate incidents are recorded when an incident does not meet the criminal threshold, but the victim perceives it to be a a hate crime. Now, Murdo Fraser, the Conservative MSP, apparently had a non-crime hate incident recorded over a tweet he wrote in which he likened identifying as non-binary to identifying as a cat. So there's a lot of confusion now about the circumstances under which a non-crime hate incident can be logged. An accusation is effectively that the police are kind of making this up as they go along.
Yeah, I mean, Police Scotland haven't sort of been particularly consistent with their approach. Well, that's the perception anyway. They're not really helping themselves. There's a lot of fears before this came in that they would struggle to sort of deal with all these complaints. And it does look like they're not treating them all the same. Like you said, Murdo Fraser was logged as a non-crime hate incident for a tweet, which was as sort of not maybe not as inflammatory as the sort of thread that J.K. Rowling put out. But police have said that she and historical sort of stuff that was thrown at the First Minister will not be logged as such. And there's not really an explanation as to why they've been treated differently. Police kind of committed to investigate every single incident, whether it made the criminal threshold or not. And there's not really been an explanation as to what the difference was, why J.K. Rowling's and Hamza Yousaf's will not be logged as a hate incident, but Murdo Fraser's was.
And where do you think this goes next? I mean, it seems likely there's going to need to be greater transparency over those non-crime hate incidents and when it's appropriate to record them. You know, there have been reports that these could be disclosed to people's employers under enhanced disclosure checks. So it is now a real concern that people have. And the police have not yet so far have not explained, you know, the circumstances under which these can be recorded, why Murdo Fraser's tweet met the threshold, why J.K. Rowling's did not. There's just no... It just doesn't seem consistent. Do you think this is going to be a problem for them going forward?
I think unless they come and clarify it, it will be a problem. It's worth saying that this isn't actually part of the new legislation. This is the recording of sort of non-crime hate incidents has been around for years. It's just obviously been thrown more to the attention with the new legislation coming out. There was concerns before this launched about the sort of process given in England and Wales after a legal challenge. They've basically stopped recording any vexatious or nonsense reports, and Police Scotland have just been kind of sat on the fence saying someone is maybe reviewing it. There was a bit of confusion at FMQs last week about whether a full review was taking place after Hamza Yousaf kind of indicated there was. So there's very much an appeal for them to change their policy or at least clear about who's going to get investigated and who isn't.
Well, I can guarantee this issue will not go away. We'll have all the latest on the Scotsman's website in the days and weeks ahead. And thank you very much, David, for speaking to me. I know you're struggling with a cold. I can hear you kind of struggling to speak. So thanks very much for your time today. But now on to something completely different. Catherine Hay, the Scotsman's rural affairs correspondent, has embarked on an epic six-month walk around Scotland as part of a radical bid to change her approach to gathering news, storytelling, to get away from her desk in Edinburgh. She set off last month and I caught up with her to find out how it's going so far. Well, Catherine Hay, thank you very much for coming on to The Steamy. I think probably first of all, it would be useful for you just to explain exactly what it is you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for inviting me on. I'm walking around Scotland because after being in this role of rural affairs correspondent at The Scotsman for just under a year, I was, you know, interviewing a lot of people from around the country and on rural issues in particular. And I started to get a little bit frustrated kind of being based in Edinburgh, given that a lot of what I was writing was in other corners of the country. And I do think a lot of rural issues can be sort of misunderstood quite easily anyway. So I felt it was much more beneficial to physically go to some of these places and meet some of these people face to face to really understand what it is that they're sort of crying out for with the government. I know that a lot of rural communities, be it in farming, fishing, but you know, it obviously extends beyond that, have been quite frustrated with legislation that's passed certainly over the last few years, and certainly more recently with bills that are going to have a real impact, like the Land Reform Bill, the Agriculture Bill. We saw last year with the HPMA legislation that ended up getting binned, you know, there was a lot of anger. So I felt like there was a real sort of momentum building in the feeling of people living in rural communities and how much they were feeling that they weren't being heard. So that was quite a big influence on wanting to physically go out and see these communities. The other thing, on a more personal note, is I do enjoy walking, and I wanted to, well, going back to my role in journalism, I wanted to sort of understand the country a bit better, and I felt by going at a slow pace, by walking, you kind of really are slowing down and talking to people and understanding them from a sort of different lens, as it were. So yeah, there's a lot of different reasons. And then in terms of kind of what I want to get out of it, I think really what I've just said is picking up on voices from these communities that you don't always get when you're kind of calling perhaps, you know, some contacts from your desk. There's certainly been a few examples where I've just been walking through some villages and small towns, and I've met people who have told me things that I wouldn't necessarily have thought of that would have been impacting their village or their town. For example, in Bankery, the fishing hotels are really struggling at the moment. And while I am very aware that the Atlantic salmon is in steep decline and the rivers are struggling and the, you know, the anglers on the river are, well, they're just not really coming back, and it means the gillies are impacted. But yeah, the hotels, the towns are struggling because you haven't got that influx of fishing visitors coming. So, you know, it means that the hotels are struggling, the pubs are struggling, because they relied on that kind of tourism, I guess. So that was quite a sort of revealing when I arrived in Bankery, and the hotels were sort of, yeah, really kind of trying to fight their corner and just say, you know, we really need the fish back in the river for our sake, but also, I mean, just for the ecosystem, for the general health of the river and the environment around it.
And I love this idea. For me, it's kind of like a throwback to the kind of golden age of journalism, you know, when journalists were kind of allowed to do these kind of, I mean, it's the nicest possible way, these kind of madcap schemes, you know, these kind of great kind of adventures, I suppose. I mean, did you go, when you started off, did you have a kind of preconceived notion of what you would experience, what you would get out of this? Or was it very much just a case of trying to take it as it comes and trying not to have a preconceived notion?
Yeah, I think really the latter, to be honest. When I planned the route, I tried to time it so that I would make certain areas just to sort of tie in with the season. So for example, in Aberdeenshire, like walking along the River Dee, I was there during the opening of the fishing season. And, you know, I dropped into Fife at the beginning of the seasonal workers coming to pick soft fruit. So there was a little bit of planning, a little bit of, you know, trying to make it to certain places in time. But I think what overrides that was, yeah, not actually having too much of a preconceived idea of what I was trying to find along the way. And I have been leaving it very open. I have been following a route that I initially planned to set out on. But yeah, I'm only 3 weeks in and still very up for sort of changing it slightly if it means kind of making a different story at a different point. I think it's important to keep an open mind when walking sort of around the country, because, you know, sometimes obviously there'll be days where I'll physically need to stop anyway, so I can't be too sort of rigid in my plan. But also there have been moments on the trip where I've been walking through an area and then, you know, there's something that's quite good and, you know, I want to sort of head off and make sure that I can interview that person. So yeah, it's not being too sort of rigid with my planning. I think that's the best thing.
How many miles are you doing a day roughly, or does it really just depend day to day?
It just depends day to day, really. The longer days tend to be between 10 and 15 miles. Annoyingly, I work in kilometres, so I'm just trying to work it out. I know that I've done, because the app that I'm using to mark the sort of footpaths that I've been on, it works in kilometres, and I know that I just mapped what I've done so far last night, and I've done about nearly 250 kilometers so far. But yeah, on average, it's working out about 10 miles a day, roughly, roughly speaking. But I obviously need to limit it because I need to make time to write the stories. And also, you know, it takes time to chat to people when I'm walking past their door. So I've just got to, yeah, make sure that it's not too long. And physically, you know, I'm going to be on the road for several months, so I have to kind of take it easy at the beginning, make sure I don't get any annoying injuries.
And how do you make time to write stories? Because I mean, I know how difficult it is to sometimes file stories using the Scottish Parliament's Wi-Fi, so it must be extraordinarily difficult if you're, you know, in a field in the middle of nowhere to try and get onto the system, file your story, make sure it's been sent to the desk. Have you had troubles of that so far?
Yes, and weirdly, the place, which I mean, was a huge surprise to me, but the place that I had the most issues was St Andrews, which was the biggest town I came across, obviously. So I started in Braemar, and went east and then dropped down the east coast. And I did a bit going inland as well, just to make sure I got some, you know, content from inland in Angus. But yeah, when I dropped down into Fife, I was like, oh, St Andrews will be fine because, you know, it's a big town and university, like there'll be internet there. I mean, I don't know if other people listening will relate, but I struggled to get even phone signal. They don't have 4G. And if they do, it's very, very thin on the ground. And cafes and restaurants I tried to go into to connect to the Wi-Fi, they all had that sort of roaming Wi-Fi where you have to log in with an email address, which when you have a work computer, it doesn't like it. They want you to have a private connection. But I was going a bit mad. I ended up doing an interview from a disabled toilet in a church because it was the only place that I could find like enough signal that was quiet and that I could sort of focus. So that was a day. And then to top it off in the evening, I arrived in Anstruther after a long day's work and a long day's walk. And there was no room at the inn. So I ended up having to camp in the coastal path in the pouring rain. That was a bit of a low point. But yeah, to be honest, again, with the route, I've made sure, you know, this isn't a walk around Scotland's wilderness. It's a walk around, you know, the places where people are living and there are farms or, you know, hospitality businesses. So I have been lucky and found, you know, pubs or hotels where I just sit in and, you know, grab a coffee and be able to do some writing. And people have been really understandable once I've explained, you know, what I'm doing and end up also getting a conversation off them and talking to them about, you know, anything in that particular area that they might want to sort of raise. So it's been fine. I think when I get to some of the more wild parts, like perhaps the very northwest and some parts of the west coast, it might be a bit more challenging. Yeah. So far, Angus and Fife have had, you know, plenty of services within a few miles. So if I've needed to charge my phone or write a story quickly or plug my laptop in, then it's been okay. So I'm not holding my breath. I don't think it's going to be like that the whole way around, but so far, so good.
And am I right in saying you're doing a kind of mixture of camping, you're staying with people, you're sort of, I guess the whole idea is to take it as it comes. Who have you stayed with so far and what kind of accommodation have you had?
Yeah, that side of things has been, I've felt so fortunate. I mean, I know I've mentioned that I had to camp recently and I don't mind camping. I have a tent with me deliberately for that reason because there will be nights where that's going to happen. And so far so good, although my sleeping bag is not cut out for this weather. I think I need to get a warmer one because yeah, it's a bit cold still. But first night stayed with Jeeva Blackett, counsellor in Braemar, very kindly offered a bed. Yeah, mostly it's been contacts who I've either made through work along the way, who I've got in touch with and just mentioned what I'm doing. And they've said, you know, please come and stay. I've also checked into a couple of hostels, which are also quite good places to just get a feel of, you know, particularly for like whether it's tourism in the area, just talking to the owners about, you know, about business. Stayed with a farmer one evening as well, who did like a tour of their farm, which was really interesting. Also stayed with Dee Ward at Rottle Estate, which was a nice day because actually the night before I'd stayed in a caravan when I went to meet some daffodil pickers on a daffodil farm in Aberdeenshire. Yeah, it's just quite interesting, the kind of contrast to what I've seen, like staying in a caravan on a daffodil farm and then stayed in like, you know, the big house at Rottle Estate. So it's been a real mix. But yeah, Scotland's really been opening up its doors to me. I've felt very lucky in that sense. I have no qualms or I'm not worried about accommodation because, as I say, I've got a tent, but people have been really, you know, when they hear, oh, that I might be camping, that's when people tend to sort of extend a hand and say, well, you're welcome to come and stay. We've got a spare room or you can camp in the garden. I'm from Scotland. My family, my dad's, you know, been here for a long time. His family date back in Scotland a long way. So yeah, we know quite a few people as well around the country who've also been really kind and stepped forward and said, you can come and stay. And actually one of my favourite stays, I'll just quickly mention, was staying with Alison Campsey, colleague at the Scotsman. That was a really special visit, staying with her in Inverbervie in Aberdeenshire.
Yeah. And just going forward, you've obviously said you've kind of come down the East Coast. I think I'm right in saying you're in Edinburgh at the moment. Do you have a route going forward, a kind of rough plan as to where you're going to go next? And do you have anything as well, that any kind of events or things that you need to get to, that you really want to get to in the coming weeks and months?
Yeah, so next is, I got to Edinburgh just yesterday and I'm just staying where I live, which is handy, just for a couple of nights to catch up on a few things. And then I'll be heading through East Lothian next. After that, I plan to drop down into the Borders and then through Dumfries and Galway. So yeah, talking of events, I do want to make the, I'm going to be coming back for the Royal Highland Show in June. And so yeah, depending on how far I get through Dumfries and Galway, I'll then either come up through Lanarkshire or I'll just try and do a little bit of the West Coast before coming back down the West Highland Way, sort of back inland, and then hopping over to Edinburgh for that. At the moment, I haven't got any particular events between now and the Royal Highland Show, but, you know, again, with lambing season in sort of in full swing right now, I'm trying to kind of make sure that I get to some of the farmers around sort of East Lothian and the Borders area to just hear how it's going really for them. I've already spoken to quite a few about it. I'm still keeping it quite open at the moment.
And when will you finish roughly? When do you expect to be done?
The trip's been sort of pitched as 6 months, but I'm trying to keep quite an open mind. And if the Scotsman allows it, and if I'm still on the road and there's still areas that I want to cover or feel like I haven't really kind of gone somewhere, then, you know, I'm quite open to it being a little bit longer. I guess one of the main points of doing it between March and sort of September, October was because, you know, the weather is a bit kinder, tends to be, in that period. So once it starts getting into winter, it'll be quite difficult to be on foot. But then again, obviously it'd be important to cover parts of Scotland when it's in the winter anyway, so if it means it's going to go on a little bit longer, then it goes on a bit longer, and I'm very open to that. And perhaps, yeah, we'll just be keeping in touch with the Scotsman obviously about it and just see how I get on and how it's going. But you know, so far I think it has really got off to a good start. I think there's been some important stories that have been covered, and certainly being out there in the rural communities there, you know, they are saying that it's good to have somebody who's sort of coming to meet people face to face. So hopefully, yeah, his way is going to keep up his way.
And just finally, is there any kind of pieces you want to point listeners towards that you've done that you're particularly proud of so far, or that you think kind of explain what you're trying to do?
And there's a couple. So I think I mentioned briefly the one about the fishing hotels. That was just, I noticed we had quite a strong level of readers on that story. I think it was quite a big issue for that area, which I noticed, and the feedback was certainly, thank you for pointing this out. It's not something that's really been covered enough. Also, my visit to Rothall Estate was quite good timing in a way, because the wildlife management and Muir Burn Bill had just gone through, and I was just awash with emails about, you know, different responses to what people thought about it, you know. And I've really been tapping into different sides of the conversation for the last few months whilst it's been sort of in the making, and it's so polarized. I mean, that's not unusual in anything to do with politics, but it's to the point where sometimes the conversations can get quite, you know, heated, to the point where you think, is there any end in sight of, you know, people agreeing on what to do about, you know, Scotland's flora and fauna. But when I arrived at Rothall Estate, I mean, there was just this kind of sense of calm, and it was very impressive what's going on there. You know, within the first couple of hours, I just saw an immense amount of wildlife, you know, lots of different raptors and birds all kind of obviously just living together on this land. And I also followed up, you know, with a couple of people who are from very different parts of the conversation, you know, who really don't agree with each other, but who all were saying that, you know, Rothall Estate is, it's quite hard to argue with what's going on there because of the success that nature is having on that land. And so it just felt like quite a nice place to arrive at when things were getting very, very political, very heated, and to arrive somewhere that was just kind of, you know, doing quite a good job of what everybody's shouting about in the background, just sort of carrying on and letting nature kind of do its thing, but also, yeah, with clever sort of insightful direction from well, it's Dee Ward who runs it, who owns it. So yeah, I would encourage people to read that to just kind of restore a little bit of faith that there are good efforts being made to help Scotland's wildlife, and not to get too sort of disorientated about the debate that can get quite difficult to kind of listen to sometimes.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Catherine. Thanks for coming on to the Steamy to explain what it is you're doing. I think it's an amazing idea. I wish you the best of luck in the future, and I hope all goes well in the weeks and months ahead. Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you.
That was Catherine Hay, the Scotsman's rural affairs correspondent, talking about her incredible six-month trek around Scotland, a brilliant idea that I think is guaranteed to produce some fascinating insights in the weeks and months to come. But that's all we've got time for in this week's podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Please stay tuned to the Scotsman's website for all the latest news and analysis. And consider subscribing if you don't already. We can't do this without your support. But until next week, thank you very much.